NHPR News. It's 9:06.
From New Hampshire Public Radio, I'm Laura Kanoy, and this is The Exchange. Thousands of protesters continue to camp out in the cold today outside the Parliament building in Kiev as Ukraine's president stands firm in his refusal to sign a trade deal with the European Union. Demonstrators see the recent decision by President Viktor Yanukovych as a clear choice in favor of Ukraine's historic patron, Russia, instead of what they want, closer integration with Western Europe. The move sparked public outrage in parts of Ukraine and demands for the president to step down. And although this issue doesn't directly affect the United States, you can be sure the State Department is watching with concern, viewing this as upholding old Cold War boundaries and rivalries and bolstering Russia's power in the region. And Ukraine is just one of many recent sources of tension surrounding the U.S.-Russia relationship. Syria also remains a point of contention. Russia's close alliance with the Assad regime has enabled diplomatic progress, but it's also put Moscow and Washington on opposite sides. Then there's Russia offering refuge to NSA leaker Edward Snowden this past summer. All of this plus longtime U.S. criticism over Russia's record on civil rights and suppression of political dissent. Today in The Exchange, Russian relations reconsidered. Let's hear from you. What's your take on this topic? Have we moved past the Cold War, or are we stuck in the same old patterns? How does Snowden's asylum in Russia affect our relationship? And what's your reaction to Russia's role in getting Syria to dispose of its chemical weapons? Give us a call. Your questions and comments are welcome at 1-800-892-6477. 1-800-892-NHPR. Send us a short email, the address exchange@nhpr.org. Post a comment on our Facebook page, NHPR Exchange, all one word. We have two guests with me in studio is Bill Martell, Associate Professor of International Security Studies at the Fletcher School at Tufts University. His research includes international relations, American foreign policy. His latest book is called Victory in War. And Bill Martell, welcome back. It's nice to see you.
Thank you so much, Laura. Always a pleasure.
Joining us from Dartmouth is Bill Woolforth, Daniel Webster Professor of Government at Dartmouth College. His research interests include international relations, Russian foreign policy, and the Cold War. He was just recently in Russia this past fall. Bill Woolforth, good to have you. Thanks for your time.
Oh, great to be here.
Well, Bill Martell, I'll start with you, but I want to hear from you too, Bill Woolforth, of course. How would you describe, Bill, the state of relations with Russia today? I mean, not a Cold War, but it's kind of chilly.
Yeah, we're all struggling for the right analogy. Is it the Cold War? Is it the chilly war? Is the temperature turning down? It's the difficulty now is that Russia has, since the end of the Cold War, really been struggling economically and politically. And what you sense, and President Vladimir Putin of Russia has said this on many occasions, that the Russians really view with great antipathy, with great unhappiness, the decline of their decline in strategic terms at the end of the Cold War. And I think a fair part, not all, but a fair part of Putin's political agenda has been to restore Russia, to restore it to its sense of greatness. They're doing this in a regional sense, putting pressure on states to adhere more closely to Russian foreign policy interests. They're doing so in terms of energy kinds of policies they've been pursuing across the region. And this puts us, the Americans, in a position where there's a bit of a clash between Moscow. During the campaign last year, the presidential campaign, all sides were very careful not to declare this a new Cold War or a Cold War redux because I think many, and I'm in the same camp, view this as we really don't want self-fulfilling prophecies. We want to sort of tread very gently here. So we have a clash between American and Russian interests, not remotely as great as existed during the Cold War, but there is a bit of a geopolitical struggle going on right now between Washington and Moscow.
What do you think, Bill Woolforth?
I agree. I mean, if you think about it from Russia's perspective, what can they do? They can't really join NATO. They can't join the EU. They're too big, too awkward, too politically incorrect really to be part of America's alliance system. So failing that, what's the option? Well, they try to pursue their interests vigorously. They try to create their own geopolitical and geoeconomic space. They try to find their own allies where they can around the world and pursuing those interests and pursuing that space, pursuing that prestige that the Russian populace and elite still crave, puts them at loggerheads with the United States now and then, inevitably. However, As Bill said, there are very strict limits on how far Vladimir Putin will allow the relationship to sour. It's just there's too much at stake. Russia can't afford a new Cold War. It knows how that would turn out for it. So there's a kind of a ambiguity in Russia-West relations, cooperation on some issues, competition and rivalry on others.
Wow. Well, that's real interesting. A couple things to pick up on that both of you guys said. Bill Martell, to you, you said these days Russia is struggling politically, and Bill Woolforth alluded to that too. You know, they still want to be a big player, but they're not really sure who to play with anymore. I understand that. But you said that they're also struggling economically. I thought Russia had, you know, all this gas and all this oil and all this economic power. I thought they were doing fine.
Yeah, to Bill's comments, with which I agreed, the problem that Russia faces is that during the Cold War, they put the vast majority of their resources into the military-industrial complex. Very brief anecdote. In the early 90s, I was a postdoc at Harvard, and the project was building what was called the Nunn-Lugar, later the Cooperative Threat Reduction Program, provide assistance to Russia, Ukraine, Kazakhstan, Belarus to dismantle the nuclear arsenals. I interviewed President Yeltsin's defense conversion advisor, and he said, what do you guys spend on defense in the U.S.? And I said, a pretty good number is 4 or 5% GDP, but it spikes during wars. And I said, how about you? He said, well, what do you think we spent? And I said, well, the CIA used to put out studies every year saying about 18 to 20% of GDP. He said, A, we don't know. And he said, B, the best guesses or estimates going on the Russian government were between 50 and 70%.
Holy moly, wow.
Whether that's, you know, right or wrong, I don't know. But it gives a sense that they gutted themselves economically over the span of a number of decades, putting so much money into defense. They also had a grossly inefficient economy. I'm sure Bill will add to this. And so what they face now is really long-term economic decline. Just this past week, a report came out which said that Russia, by every measurable indicator, population shrinking, consumer base shrinking, energy resources are going down. This is an economy that survives 50%-ish of Russia's national income is from selling oil and gas overseas. We have just displaced, in terms of energy production, both Russia and Saudi Arabia for daily production of oil and gas. So they are in a world of hurt economically. As Bill said, and I'd amplify his point, is they can't afford a strategic arms race with us. They know this. President, now Prime Minister Medvedev, said at one point, he said, Russia can't be a world-class economic power unless we can build world-class microchips. They don't yet do this. So they have the remnants of a strategic superpower military complex, which is still falling apart in lots of ways, but nothing in the category of a first tier or world-class economic economy. They're really a secondary or tertiary power in economic terms.
Wow, that's interesting. They must have a good PR effort then, Bill Woolforth, because they don't project that image that they're hurting so much economically. That's interesting. What do you think?
Well, there is – I would amend that only slightly to say that they just gone through and are now coming to the end of a pretty significant spurt of fast growth, well ahead of any of the United States or its chief allies, ranging in the sort of 4 to 7, 8% GDP per year category, partly indeed primarily from natural resource exports. But the result of this is the creation of a substantial Russian middle class, the creation of pockets of the country that really compare to Europe in terms of per capita GDP. Just to give you a sense, per capita income in Russia is estimated by the CIA to be around $17,000, $18,000, $19,000 per person per year. Ukraine, the country we're going to talk about later, is at about 7,000. Russia is a middle-income country. It has had some economic successes. But Bill is right that the long-term prognosis doesn't look that great. So what we've got to understand when we're dealing with Russia is we're dealing with a country that's kind of feeling its oats in a way. We're back. We're doing better. We have this glittering city in Moscow. We have this person we think of as a super competent President Putin who wangles cool diplomatic deals across the world stage. We're feeling we should get some respect for the amount of success that we've had. But at the same time, as Bill says, looking down the road, things don't look so great. Growth is now down. Forecasts are bad. There's going to be pressure on the state budget. So we've got this combination of confidence but also concern that leads to some of the pugnacious behavior you sometimes observe.
Let's invite our listeners to join us again. The number here in the exchange is 1-800-892-6477. Today in the exchange, U.S.-Russia relations, what's next? These ties have always been complicated, of course, but as we're hearing recently, they've heated up even more. Whether it's how to approach the war in Syria, Russia's protection of NSA leaker Edward Snowden, and as we'll talk about in just a minute, the recent tug of war over Ukraine, they've all contributed to tension. We'd like your questions and comments about this at 1-800-892-6477, 1-800-892-NHPR. Send us a short email if you'd like, exchange@nhpr.org. You can also post a comment on our Facebook page. It's NHPR Exchange. All one word. Again, the number 1-800-892-6477. Okay, so Bill Wolforth, since you mentioned Ukraine, let's go there. It's been a big story this week. I mentioned it in the introduction. What, if anything, Bill, does this have to do with the United States? It seems to be largely between Russia, Ukraine, and the European Union.
It does, although U.S. and EU interests align in this instance, because what the pact that was being negotiated between Kiev and Brussels was about was essentially aligning Ukraine's economic governance and trade practices closer to those of the EU. And of course, if you're to look at from a global perspective, that's pretty much in consort with how the United States prefers that countries run their economies and manage their trade. And basically, it's true what a lot of commentators have said, that this was in some sense, at some level, a civilizational kind of choice. Where are we in the world, Ukraine? Are we West or not? Are we fully and truly and completely European or not? And clearly, if you ask American policymakers where they'd like Ukraine to go, there's no question they prefer it to be moving towards, have the promise of European Union membership or at least close association.
Bill Martell.
To Bill's comments, I would add that Ukraine sits in an awkward geopolitical position, geostrategic position. They sit between Russia to their east and Europe to their west, one. Second, they look at Russia and they see authoritarian impulses on the part of Putin. They see a government that's much less democratic than we hoped it would be. They see an economy that's moribund or declining or weak. And they saw the EU relationship as one where they could potentially cast their lot with Europe, thinking it would be more prosperous, more politically palatable, and the like.
A lot more to talk about on that point. So we will follow up for sure after a short break, including an article in the New York Times recently that indicates some feel the EU kind of muffed it and didn't approach this the right way. We'll talk a lot more after a short break. Stay with us.
This is New Hampshire Public Radio, 919. Good morning. You're invited to join the Walter Peterson Legacy Society by including NHPR in your estate plan. When you do, you help ensure our on-air service to the New Hampshire community for years to come. For more information about the Walter Peterson Legacy Society and our many planned giving options, visit nhpr.org. Support for NHPR comes from you, our members, and support also comes to us from the Clean Bedroom Organic Mattress and Bedding Showroom in Kittery, Maine, helping you create eco-friendly sleep environments, also at thecleanbedroom.com. From Elliott Urgent Care in downtown Manchester, an alternative to an emergency department for accidents, illnesses, and injuries, or when your doctor's office is closed, ElliottRiversEdge.org. And Capital Center for the Arts in Concord presenting Mannheim Steamroller Christmas by Chip Davis, Wednesday, December 11th at 7:30. Tickets at ccanh.com. Cloudy today, chance of some rain, highs from upper 30s ranging to mid-40s. This is NHPR.
This is The Exchange. I'm Laura Kanoy. Today in The Exchange, we're exploring the complicated and often tense U.S. relations with Russia. We want to hear from you. Call in 1-800-892-6477. Email exchange@nhpr.org. Post a comment on our Facebook page, NHPR Exchange, all one word. What's your take on this topic? Have we moved past the Cold War, or are we stuck in the same old patterns that we've seen for decades? How do you think Russia's protection of Edward Snowden, the NSA leaker, affects the relationship? And what's your reaction to Russia's recent role in getting Syria to dispose of its chemical weapons? Give us a call. We'd love your questions. 1-800-892-6477. Again, the email is exchange@nhpr.org. www.dartmouthcollege.org. And Bill Wolforth from Dartmouth College and Bill Martell with the Fletcher School at Tufts University. Just before the break, we were talking about Ukraine and how Ukraine's president recently decided not to sign trade agreements with the European Union. The United States, as you said, Bill Wolforth, clearly would like Ukraine to move more in that Western European direction. I came across an interesting op-ed piece from the New York Times written by someone who has studied this issue. He's a professor of politics at the University of Rhode Island. So he's got his own opinion. And it was, Bill Wolforth, that the European Union kind of approached this in the wrong way, not paying attention to the historic and cultural ties between Russia and Ukraine, kind of treating, as he put it, Ukraine as someone who could possibly caddy for the exclusive golf course but never become a full-fledged member. What do you think?
Well, there's something to that. I think that in the EU's defense, Ukraine's not an easy actor to deal with. It's a country that's deeply riven by political contradictions and with a rather corrupt and inefficient governing system, a lot of oligarchs, a lot of problems, a lot of difficulties. Not so easy to negotiate with this type of with this country, and with Putin looming in the background makes it even more difficult. But I think where things might have been messed up, and what a lot of people don't realize, is that Ukraine is basically in a very parlous economic state. If you think Russia's got problems, Ukraine's really got problems in that they've got an overvalued currency, they've got massive debt, and basically Yanukovych knows, the president of Ukraine, that they are in the near term, they're going to have to pay the piper, and they're in for some economic reckoning, and it's not going to be pretty, and it's not going to be popular, and he's not going to get reelected if he is associated with the pain that is going to be inflicted on Ukrainian citizens. And the bottom line is Putin just gave him a better deal in the short term. And when problems loom, when big-time recessions are threatening, politicians tend to think short term, and Russia could deliver there. The EU was just not capable, even though you could – if you look back at the record, you'll see essentially pleas from Kiev saying, please, can you basically make this more lucrative for us in the near term in order to swallow this deal now. I think that Putin can deliver these short-term palliatives to the Ukrainian economy that the EU deal couldn't, and therefore for a politician trying to stay in power, it was a choice that it was an offer he couldn't refuse. So that's where my main I don't know if it's criticism, it would just be sort of analysis of the EU's failure would be, is they just weren't ready to play that kind of game the way Moscow was.
Well, one more question on this for you, Bill Martell, and then I do want to turn to Edward Snowden, because that's been a big point of tension between the U.S. and Russia. But one more question about Ukraine, since it has been in the news so much. Three former Ukrainian presidents yesterday came out, Bill Martell, in favor of the protesters, said they support what they're doing.
Yeah, as I know your listeners all know, back in 2004 we had what was called the Orange Revolution in Ukraine, which had hundreds of thousands, maybe millions of people in the streets in Kiev and across the country protesting elections that were seen to be rigged. And this past several days, week or so, we've had hundreds of thousands of people in the streets of Kiev, the capital of Ukraine, protesting the decision by the government of Yanukovych, not to sign the deal with the EU. So there is this, and Bill mentioned this, there's a split within Ukraine. The eastern parts of the country tend to be closer to Russia. The western parts of the country tend to be more allied, if you will, and I put that term in quotes, allied with Europe. So Ukraine is split down the middle between those who see their future with that of Russia, and for all the points reasons we've discussed this morning, that may be a very weak short-term and immensely weak options long-term for Russia, for Ukraine, given how weak Russia is economically long-term. And then there's the political side of this. So you have people that are arguing that Russia shows – people in Ukraine – Russia shows much more authoritarianism. There's a rock group in jail, one of whom is a mother, because they used language that was offensive to Putin, her serving time in a gulag and a penal colony in Russia. The system is much more authoritarian. The economy is weak. So there's a part of Ukraine, probably half or more of the population, which is saying, we do not want to cast our lot with Russia. We want to be part of Europe. I am sure they're all what the diplomats would call the economic modalities, all the details of how we could wicker this deal between the EU and Ukraine. But the strategic calculation for Ukraine was, do we want to look to the east, to Moscow, or the West to the EU and to the United States. In some ways, this is a NATO expansion redux, a redone. In the last decade and a half, we were trying to expand NATO to the East as best we could, and that worked varyingly well. Now this is the second phase, in a sense, of trying to expand economic relationships with Ukraine. It also had other interesting political kinds of conditions in terms of governance, which Bill mentioned a while ago. For example, to sign that agreement with the EU would have meant that former President Tymoshenko would have to be released from jail. There are human rights issues and tariff issues, all kinds of...
Wow, so a lot more complicated
than just...
It's
a very complicated deal. My own gut is we haven't seen the end of this yet, both in terms of Ukrainian politics and in terms of the EU.
All right, I have to ask both of you about something that very directly affects U.S. Russia relations beyond the Ukraine issue, which the U.S. is definitely watching, as you both said. And that's Edward Snowden. And Bill Wolfson, you said earlier that Putin can't let the U.S. relationship sour too much. That wouldn't work out well for him, you said. And yet, you know, you hear that and you go, wow, he did give protection to Edward Snowden. He seems very happy to have Mr. Snowden there. So how does that fit into the calculation?
Snowden fell into Moscow's lap, essentially. As far as we know, he kind of got the Russians got rather late warning that the plane was headed to Moscow, and then he's holed up in the Sheremetyevo airport there for, I don't remember, it was weeks. So this thing sort of fell into Putin's lap. I think there's no serious intelligence analyst in the United States who for a second really believes there's any possibility that Putin would ever hand Edward Snowden over to the U.S. authorities. It's simply no surprise. So in that sense, it's really not that bad for the relationship because he's doing nothing that we don't expect him to do. And in fact, I admit there are big differences between Russia and the United States. One's a democracy, one's a deeply flawed democracy, if not an autocracy. But that said, imagine if the roles were reversed and a Russian whistleblower leaker who potentially might be viewed in that light ended up in Dulles Airport in Washington, D.C. There is no chance in heck that we would have handed that guy over to Russia. And similarly, it would be deeply and genuinely and sincerely unpopular in Russia for Putin now to decide to hand over Snowden to the United States. So that particular decision to give him sanction, give him sanctuary, probably in and of itself is not hugely damaging to the relationship, as he's just simply doing what we would expect him to do. No real surprise.
Not hugely damning.
I'm heely agreeing with Bill because I don't think anybody thinks that the Russians would ever let Snowden go. In fact, this weekend there were reports they're asking Michael Hayden, who was a former head of both the CIA and the NSA. And they said, can you confirm reports that are being public reports that Snowden has said if anything ever happens to him, he will release things that will be beyond damaging to the United States? And Hayden said, I'm not in government. I can't tell, but I've heard those rumors. I can't confirm or deny that they're the case. There's something that is called the damage assessment. After something like Snowden happens, the intelligence committee goes back and said, well, what exactly did this guy have and what kind of damage did he do? I don't think we'll ever hear about that in public, frankly, but I think the sense you get from folks is that there was a lot of damage done there, and I think the Russians, know that, and I think that that's something that will put further strains on the relationship between the United States and Russia. Having noted, everybody has been spying on each other since the Roman Empire and the Byzantine Empire. I mean, this is sort of the coin of the realm. Everybody spies, and that's why when all the Europeans a few months ago were saying, "Oh my God, this is terrible! The Americans are spying." Your reactions, but everybody's doing this. But this remains a lesser point, but still a bit of a sticking point between Washington and Moscow, the case of Edward Snowden.
It was sort of seen, though, right, Bill, as a slap in the face that Russia provided asylum for this
absolutely,
guy.
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. And in fact, at the time, the Obama administration was pushing very heavily, strenuously, to persuade the Russians not to do this. And you could see clearly from the beginning the Russians were never going to adhere to that line, that they're going to they were never going to release Snowden. In fact, they'd be probably, from their point of view, foolish to do so because it would look like they're, as the expression goes, kowtowing to the Americans, being deferential to us when that is totally antithetically opposed to everything that Putin stands for in a geopolitical and geostrategic sense.
Again, our number here in the exchange for you to join us with your questions or comments is 1-800-892-6477. We're exploring recent tensions in the U.S.-Russia relationship today in the exchange. We'd love to hear from you, 1-800-892-6477. Email exchange at nhpr.org. You can also post a comment on our Facebook page, NHPR Exchange. You know, Bill Woolforth, one more question for you on this Edward Snowden story, and then I do want to turn to Syria, because that's really interesting. But Bill Woolforth, you were in Russia in September. Was anybody still talking about this Edward Snowden affair, or had people pretty much said, you know, this is the status quo and it'll probably stay this way?
Well, ironically, what was going on in Russia when I was there was the G20 summit in St. Petersburg while I was in Peter. And all of the talk was over, of course, this diplomatic intervention by Sergei Lavrov, the Russian foreign minister, on the whole Syria chemical weapons issue. On Snowden, he was kind of laying low. You didn't see a lot of stuff in the press about him. They've been very, very careful with him. There have been a lot of leaks, you know, the usual stuff about, beautiful Russian women, you know, proposing marriage to him, or they want to go out with him, they want to have a date with him, and all this sort of stuff. There's a couple of famous Russian ex-spies who are back from the United States. There's kind of a little bit of a media swirl around, you know, what's Snowden going to do with himself. But it was pretty low. I have to say it was pretty low profile at that time in the Russian media.
Well, let's talk about then what you said was the bigger story while you were there, and certainly remains a huge story. And Bill Martell, of course, that's Syria, as Bill Woolforth said. Just remind us, Bill, let's roll back the time machine a little bit if we could, what the events were that led up to this agreement that Russia helped with to dispose of Syria's chemical weapons.
Yeah, that we established a couple red lines, two actually. President Obama said if the Syrians move or use chemical weapons, that would constitute a red line for us. And they moved or used in the spring of this year, and they moved or used end of August, and they killed several thousand people. So this led to a bit of a diplomatic crisis, and there was a point here at the very end of August, and Secretary Kerry gave a speech in which it looked like he was setting the stage for American intervention the next day. And then the president said, no, we won't do that until — we talked about the show a couple months ago — we won't use military force until the Congress weighs in, this sort of thing. Now, the Russian — what created all this is Kerry said, unless the Syrians give up their nuclear chemical weapons, we're going to have to use military force effectively. And then the Russians came along, President Putin and Foreign Minister Lavrov said, well, we can broker a deal with the Syrians because the Russians are very close to the Syrians economically, politically, and so forth, the military assistance. And that led to an agreement whereby the chemical weapons in Syria would be removed. Now, we just saw this morning, actually, in the Wall Street Journal report that no country is willing to take those weapons. So apparently the administration this past weekend floated what the Wall Street Journal called a Plan B, which is to basically dispose of those chemical weapons out at sea using special ships to do so. So this was important on two dimensions. One, it's really dangerous, as we talked about a while ago, to declare red lines and not to stick to them. And secondarily, it really shifted the geopolitical center of gravity really from, I think, the U.S. more toward Moscow. It looked like the Russians and Putin and Lavrov, the foreign minister, were really playing a much more deft, much more able hand diplomatically in this crisis. And I think that really helped to recenter, if you will, or restore Russia's influence in geopolitical sense. And I think that event, probably purely a surprise sort of event, really changed that geopolitical dynamic between the United States and Russia.
Yeah, it kind of bolstered their image, didn't it, Bill Woolforth? Before, Putin and his crew kind of had a reputation, rightly or wrongly, as sort of bullies, you know, and trying to get other countries to join their economic union. And if you don't, we'll cause economic trouble for you. And, you know, you see silly pictures of Putin on the internet and so forth. And then this happened, and some people said, hey, they're the grown-ups in the room now.
They did actually look that way. They looked that way because they were that way. In that particular instance, they are diplomatically just outclassed the United States in that particular episode. And of course, that can't compensate for all the myriad other weaknesses of Russia's position in the world that we discussed before. But still, that's just the reality. You know, the Russians get a — I got to say, as somebody who studies Russia, you know, I got to deal with these Putin pictures online. He's doing the tiger. He's getting the amphora out of the wreck on the bottom of the ocean. He's scuba diving. He's he's seen as this dictator. But, you know, reality is Russia, while it's definitely not a nice democratic country, it's a much more of a mixed story. I just want to put that out there that, for example, it's far less autocratic than China. I mean, you can go to Russia, you can log on to the New York Times, you can listen to NHPR on your computer. I mean, none of that is possible in China. But somehow, because of Putin's image, he manages to kind of create this meme. He creates this narrative about Russia that is, it's got a basis in truth, but it's a little bit overstated in a lot of the commentary. On that issue in particular with Syria, that's one of a number of issues on which, if you were, I think, to ask American officials right now how they view the relationship, that they're positive signs. I mean, we'd rather that they didn't support Bashar al-Assad's regime. But at the end of the day, this was an extremely convenient diplomatic maneuver from our perspective. And similarly, I don't know if we're going to talk about it in this program later, but on Iran, Russia played a kind of mixed game. But at the end of the day, on those recent tranche of sanctions against Iran, Russia was on board. And I think if you talk to American officials, they'd say they appreciate the cooperation they've had from Russia on Iran. So there's a couple of these issues where Russia gains influence by virtue of being more favorably – having better relations with countries at which we're at loggerheads. But then they don't fully accept the position of being 100% opposed to the United States. They will cooperate when they see it as being in their strategic interest.
Interesting. Bill Martell, go ahead.
Yeah, I would add to that a couple of thoughts. One is I think everyone across the political spectrum in the United States and on a global scale knows that we really can't operate in the international system without dealing with the Russians or the Chinese or others. You can't for a time we essentially disregarded Russia because it was seen as so economically weak and just, you know, and really falling apart in lots of different ways. That has changed, and I think Putin, one of his legacies will be to restore Russia's sense of position within the international system. The other point I'd make is if you listen to the issues we've been talking about this morning, it's de facto the point that Russia is back in the geopolitical, geostrategic game. We've been talking about Ukraine, about Syria. Bill just mentioned Iran, China, and the Russia-China relationship is important. We talk about energy issues. We talk about diplomacy. So Russia's global footprint in a strategic sense clearly is on the ascent. Now, you can argue that is a natural consequence of their place in the international system. You can argue in part it's a little bit of ineptness on our part. On occasion, we just didn't handle things as well as we might. But I think we're beyond the post-Cold War era of a clear – we call it the unipolar moment. The United States is the one player, and the Cold War was a bipolar moment. Now we have what everyone's referring – Bill and many others have written as well – is a multipolar kind of environment because we have the United States, we have Russia, and we had China, which are the great powers – who are still jockeying to figure out what it is they care about. But Russia has in a sense, restored its place in the game, which is going to cause, on occasion, fits for us. On other occasions, it'll work well. We'll accomplish good things together. And it'll be the usual mixed bag in diplomacy.
Well, and is that largely, Bill Martell, because of Vladimir Putin and his, you know, use of power, his ability to use his power effectively?
I think it's two things. I think one is Putin has been a much more effective diplomatic player than we have. And I think second, the United States, having been 10 years in war, 5 years in economic downturn, a country that just doesn't really want to play that much, an administration that probably wants to disengage a bit from the world, I think all those have helped change that geopolitical mix.
All right. Bill Martell, I know you have to leave us. Thank you very much for being with us.
Always my pleasure, Laura. Take care.
Bill Martell again with the Fletcher School at Tufts University. We'll continue our conversation in just a minute, so stay with us.
This is New Hampshire Public Radio, 939. Good morning.
On the next Diane Rehm Show, why the U.S. Constitution might be at the root of Washington dysfunction, then ongoing state efforts to keep juveniles out of adult courts and prisons. All coming up on the Diane Rehm Show.
The Diane Rehm Show this morning from 10 till noon on NHPR. Support for NHPR comes from you, our members, and support also comes to us from New Hampshire Liquor and Wine Outlets, offering holiday gift-giving ideas of wine and spirits, including a selection of more than 7,000 wines in 77 stores located throughout New Hampshire. And from Dana-Farber New Hampshire Oncology, Hematology in Londonderry, offering consultations with disease specialists from Dana-Farber in Boston, online at danafarber.org/Londonderry. Good morning, it's 9:40. This is NHPR.
This is The Exchange. I'm Laura Kanoy. Tomorrow in the Exchange, it's our Friday New Hampshire News Roundup. Email us your thoughts on the top news stories of the week before the program at exchange@nhpr.org, or post a comment on our Facebook page, NHPR Exchange, and join us tomorrow morning live at 9. Today, we're looking at Russia-U.S. relations and the many tensions between them lately, from Edward Snowden to Syria. Give us a call, 1-800-892-6477. 1-800-892-NHPR. For the rest of the hour, Bill Wolforth is with us, Daniel Webster Professor of Government at Dartmouth College and an expert in international relations and Russian foreign policy. One more time, that exchange number is 1-800-892-6477. I wanted to turn to a question that just came in from Facebook, Bill Wolforth, and this is from John in Concord. He says, China is investing heavily in Africa. Does this play into the Russo-Sino relations? Also, how do your guests see Russian involvement in the tensions over territorial disputes among China, Japan, and Korea? It's a great question, Bill, because we tend to focus on Russia as it's, it relates to Europe and the United States, but it's also an Asian nation. So thanks for the Facebook post, John.
Yeah, awesome question, John, because a huge portion of Russian territory is sitting out in the Far East. A lot of natural resources, but very, very few people. Indeed, I think Russian Siberia is the most sparsely inhabited landmass of that size anywhere. And so they've got to navigate the situation with China. They can boast no such success on the international scene economically that China has achieved. In fact, Russians, I think, are only slowly coming to terms with the fact that they're not I mean, let's just put it clearly. I mean, the United States remains the most influential country in the world. But I think if you were to poll most people, okay, who's number two? Who do you name after the U.S.? It's got to be China. China is just on everybody's mind. China is everywhere. And slowly in Moscow, people are beginning to realize, wait a minute, we're kind of like, we're really not in the same class with China in many respects. So they have got to sort of navigate this. However, what they've done so far is they've maintained a what they call a strong strategic partnership with China that has sometimes had certain kind of opposition to the U.S. Tone to it. And therefore, their tendency in all of the East Asian disputes that John mentions would be to take China's position. And so that's the situation as it stands now, although I detect a certain degree of angst among policymakers in Moscow and the commentariat about whether this thing is really sustainable. I mean, at some point, do we, the Russians, risk becoming China's junior partner? We've thought all this time about it. We don't want to be America's junior partner. Do we want to be China's junior partner? Can we continue to stick with this line without risking that outcome?
Wow, now that's a flip from the 70s and 80s, isn't it, when China had to decide, you know, whether it wanted to be a little more cozy with the United States or be a little more cozy with Russia. That's a flip, isn't it?
Huge flip. When you take a country of a billion people and have it growing at 10% a year for 20 years, you know, that just changes a heck of a lot in the world. China is now the world's number two economy. It dwarfs Russia, and it's not just its sheer economic size, but its importance to the global economy, its significance, the degree to which people pay attention and care about what its policymakers say and do. It's quite remarkable. Russia, of course, maintains, as Bill Martell was saying before, a huge kind of legacy of a superpower that gives it a say in regions all around the world. It also has geography on its side when it seeks international influence because it borders, you know, it's the center of Eurasia. It borders on all these key areas. But boy, when it comes to, you know, go to Africa and ask what people think about, you know, do they care about what Moscow says about this or that? You know, by and large, no.
Wow. All right. Well, John, thanks again for the comment. And let's go to the phones. And Ben's waiting in Hudson. Hi, Ben. You're on the Exchange. Go ahead.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I just had a quick question. I was hoping that your guest could just quickly explain how Russia has become more of a capitalist country in many ways economically, and in how some ways the United States has become more of a socialist country. Just saying how they've become more of their opposite, even though they wouldn't claim that, but the economic reality is that has happened.
Okay, Ben, thanks a lot for the call. Go ahead, Bill Wolforth.
Well, it was a long and troubled road from the planned economy of the Soviet era to what Russia has today. And by no means is it you know, what we would call a fully
formed capitalist country, in at least the sense that it has a very, very strong role for state-owned enterprises, large, massive, hugely influential corporations that have majority stakes in them owned by the Russian government.
So they still have that.
Oh, yes, they do, but they're operating in a more of a free market context. That is to say, they are selling and buying in markets rather than through central planning. But the ownership of the company, of some of these large companies, Gazprom, the giant Russian gas firm, I mean, you can just name a long list of these global billion-dollar corporations, are controlling on the governing boards and share ownership of these corporations is the Russian government itself. That's why it somehow seems to turn out, bizarrely, that when you get a job at the high-level Russian government, somehow these people all end up getting rich. I mean, it's not clear, but, I mean, just fabulous wealth is accumulated. Partly it's because of this synergistic, you know, sort of a close relationship between government service and service for these various corporations. So it's a kind of a – people call it a crony capitalism. You can call it a kind of corporatist capitalism. There's a lot of terms for it, but just to give you – Just to finish this up here, the concentration of wealth in Russia. People complain about it in the United States. President Obama gave a speech about it yesterday. Well, the concentration of wealth in Russia is far more dramatic at the top than it is even in the United States, where the concentration of wealth has increased, as Obama said, dramatically over the past 20 years. So Russia is very, very powerful influenced by a very, very small group of mega oligarchs who are either in or around the government or filter between the government and these huge corporations.
So can you call it a market economy or not, Bill?
Well, the prices are generally driven by markets. So, I mean, I'm an old guy. I used to go there back in the Soviet days. I remember what a real Soviet-type economy was like. There's no market. There's a central planning organization that basically decides how many toothbrushes they're going to make. So it's not like that anymore. It's a market. There's stock ownership. There's private ownership of the means of production, not, of course, the crown jewels of the Russian economy. You know, but it's a market economy, but it's a kind of a type of oligarchical type of capitalism that is fragile and that it creates different interests for Russia. And so that's a sort of undertone of the whole conversation we've been having on this show, is that countries like Ukraine and neighbors of Russia, when they decide to hook up economically with this thing, the Russian economy, it's going to be a little bit different, given the way that economy runs, than if you're connecting to the EU or the United States or the global economy writ large.
Well, Ben, it's a great question. Thank you for calling in. Again, the number 1-800-892-6477. And waiting in Andover is Don. Hi, Don. You're on the air. Go ahead.
Thank you, Laura. I'm interested in I've seen great Russian scientists who were expatriates from the White Russian era come to this country and have great respect for Russian science. But I just am amazed that Russia has never had a Silicon Valley and never let its science develop the way we have. And it's pathetic in my estimation.
You know, that's really interesting. He's right. I mean, there have been a lot of great Russian scientists who've come to this country to do their work. Why hasn't it taken off on Russian soil, Bill Woolforth?
There still is just a remarkably talented Russian scientific elite. It's just extraordinary that even with all of the changes that have happened, all of the decline in funding for higher education, all of the turmoil, all of the tribulations of the last 20 or 30 years, it's still that system produces some brilliant mathematicians, physicists, economists, and so on and so forth. Many of them do end up abroad. Many of them are attracted by the private sector, where a super smart math genius whiz kid geek can earn, you know, gazillions of rubles by helping these corporations get rich. But partly it's that Silicon Valleys are not things that some government just decides to create. Putin really wants to create a Silicon Valley. He's talked about it ever since he was prime minister and then president back in the early 2000s. But governments just don't say, okay, you know, build a Silicon Valley over here. They can try to put the conditions in place, but they really can't do it. And that question really does capture this difference between the two economies that is still a far greater state-directed role in Russia, far less of an opportunity for entrepreneurship to take off almost autonomously or the way it did in the United States. And that's a big issue going forward. Is Russia going to
be a resource-extracting, selling economy? Is it going to be a Saudi Arabia of the North, or is it going to actually have a knowledge-based economy? That's the big question. And most people think, as long as they maintain this Putin-type system that we've been talking about, their chances of ever getting towards this knowledge-based economy are slim indeed.
Well, it's interesting, too, because when you talk about space science, when the shuttle program ended a year or so ago, there was some talk that, we don't have a shuttle going up to the International Space Station anymore. We have to hitch a ride with the Russians.
Yes, they do. Again, this is one of those legacies of the Soviet era, that they invested hugely in this rocket technology, and they maintained it and they sustained it, and they've used commercially, they've used it to earn money to try to sustain that sector of their economy. But again, we are not sure how long that's going to last. But for now, if you want space lift, if you want to get tonnage into space, Russia's your man.
Well, interesting. You know, I wanted to ask you about something, Bill Wilforth, that you mentioned earlier on in the program, and that's loosely called civil rights violations, or at least a lack of respect for civil rights. What is sort of standing out for people in the international human rights community? For example, one of you mentioned a rock band that has been jailed because it had some anti-Putin lyrics. What are we sort of talking about here?
Yeah, that's the case of the dramatically named Pussy Riot group, which performed what would have been considered shockingly lyrics in an Orthodox church, and won themselves the approbation of the state and jail sentences. The human rights situation is not good. There's very strong restrictions on civil society, on non-governmental organizations. Political parties are exist. Unlike China, we have more than one party in Russia. But these parties are basically creatures of the government. They're sort of loyal opposition. Needless to say, the legislation recently passed regarding so-called propaganda for a non-standard, a non-traditional marriage. So there's a very bad climate in Russia from the standpoint of gay rights. Political opponents are hounded through the use of the legal system. It's not a pretty picture. I will say, however, that there are some aspects of Russia that might go against this image. I mean, certainly the media, print media, newspapers are completely free. I mean, you can read anything in there, even the most radical anti-Putin things. The internet, Russians have free access to the internet, unlike their compatriots in China. So there's a few places in where there's this possibility to organize in Russia. There's a really strong opposition figure, Alexei Navalny, this guy who organized those protests in Moscow, who was jailed, but then they let him out. There's no figure like that in Chinese politics. It just can't exist. So yes, it's authoritarian. Yes, it's bad for human rights. But it has got a little bit more space for the flow of information for some civil society than at least some of the Western media coverage would suggest.
Well, and the Western media has covered this gay rights issue, given that there are the Olympic Games, the Winter Games coming up in Sochi, not that far away, early next year. Putin has really made great pains to say everyone's welcome and so forth, but there's no talk of repealing this law. So how do you tie that together, Bill?
You know, I tie it together. There's political opportunism on the part of the parliamentarian who put that law through the Russian parliament, the Duma. There is the reality that the society in Russia has not undergone the transformation that has happened in the West and the United States. Literally, in the past 10 years, I stand just astonished and delighted personally, but astonished by the changes in public attitudes in this country towards the rights of gay people. And this has not happened in Russia. They're where we were in 1960 or 1970. They're in sort of madman territory when it comes to public attitudes towards non-traditional relationships. And so these politicians are feeding off of and profiting from wildly popular attitudes in Russia, a country that has undergone this transition. So that's the origins and the reason that legislation is not going anywhere. But the Olympic officials, the leadership of that country, know darn well that if they get a scandal at their Olympics associated with it, it's going to ruin the whole purpose of that Olympics for Russia, which is to be its coming out party, like the Beijing Olympics were for China. They really want this to be good PR for Russia, and they know perfectly well what a catastrophe it would be
for Russia's own interests, where any sorts of discrimination, of persecution, of harassment to occur to those athletes during that Olympics.
All right, I want to get one more call in if we could. And Frank in Bedford, go ahead, please. We're heading into the end of the hour, Frank, so if you could keep it short, I'd sure appreciate it. Go ahead.
Sure, I'll try to do that, Laura. You don't hear much mention in the press about the fact that 17 journalists have been murdered in Russia since the year 2000. The reporter Anna Politkovskaya, who was murdered on October 7, 2006, which happens to be Putin's birthday. She'd written a number of critical articles about him. The murder's never been solved. It's the most dangerous country in the world for a journalist to be writing in. And we don't hear anything about that. George W. Bush said, I looked into Putin's soul. He's a good man. Well, that's absolute nonsense. Putin's basically a common street thug, former head of the KGB. Why doesn't our press highlight any of that?
You know, Frank, I'm glad you raised that, especially as a journalist myself. You're right. It's chilling to hear about the journalists who have been killed or have sort of just disappeared. Go ahead, Bill Woolforth, please.
There are far worse countries to be a journalist in. Let's get that clear. But yeah, it's a terrible place, and from that perspective, and these are very suspicious, very bad stories in each of these cases that the caller referred to. It's indefensible. On the other hand, at least in contrast with many other countries, journalists can continue to do their work and do bravely. Continue to write the most devastating exposés on the nature of that regime and what it's been up to. So kudos to them for continuing to do it, but he's absolutely right that the climate for journalism there is far from ideal. I will say very quickly, though, that I don't think the press has dropped the ball on portraying Putin as a kind of a thug. I mean, that's all over the press.
All right. Well, we have run out of time. It's been really interesting. I had a couple more questions for you, Bill, but we'll leave them for the next time. Thank you very much for being here.
Great. Thank you. Thank you for having me.
Bill Woolforth, Daniel Webster Professor of Government at Dartmouth College. His research interests include international relations, Russian foreign policy, and the Cold War. The Exchange is a production of New Hampshire Public Radio. The engineer is Dan Colgan. Our producers are Ellen Grimm and Faith Meixel. Our volunteers are John Barrett and Alan Cohen. Our theme music was composed by Bob Lord. The Exchange's executive producer is Keith Shields. And I'm Laura Kanoy.
The views expressed in this program are those of the individuals and not those of NHPR, its Board of Trustees, or its underwriters. If you missed any part of today's program, listen to The Exchange anytime at nhpr.org.
I'm Laura Kanoy, and tomorrow on The Exchange, it's our Friday New Hampshire News Roundup. The man convicted of infecting dozens of patients with hepatitis C is sentenced to 4 decades in prison. New Hampshire's transportation commissioner has dire predictions about his department's finances and its future. And a fixture of New Hampshire's political past gets ready for a big comeback. Send us your thoughts by email, Facebook, and join us for The Exchange tomorrow morning live at 9 and again at 8 p.m. on NHPR.
This is New Hampshire Public Radio, 959. Good morning. The Diane Rehm Show next at 10. Support for NHPR comes from UR members and from Liberty Utilities, sponsors of Button Up New Hampshire, energy-saving workshops, including one at Breathe New Hampshire in Manchester on December 11th. Details at breathenh.org. And Heritage Plumbing, Heating, Cooling, Electric, and now offering electrical repair and service, in addition to furnaces, boilers, and water heaters. Online at justcallheritage.com.
These are the stations of New Hampshire Public Radio.
WEVO, Concord, 89.1.
WEVS, Nashua, 88.3.
WEVH, Hanover, 91.3.
WEVN, Keene, 90.7.
WEVC, Gorham, 107.1.
WEVJ, Jackson, 99.5.
WEVF, Colebrook, 90.3.
And WEVQ, Littleton, 91.9.
And online at nhpr.org.
It's 10 o'clock.
From WAMU and NPR in Washington, I'm Diane Rehm. In today's fractured nation, there's one thing Americans seem to agree on. Government is not working. Last month, a Gallup poll showed Americans' approval of the way Congress is handling its job dropped to a record low of 9%. And the president